and 1560 WGOV 96.1 FM, 8 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock a.m. And Dennis, I'm telling you, this show is getting ready to go down in history today.
I'm going to take your word for it.
I'm just going to tell you. I'm just saying.
No, we do have some very special guests in the studio on this morning, which is one of the many reasons why I love the WGLB Morning Mix, because we have some of the greatest interviews and guests that come in.
Going down in history.
To inspire us and to keep us informed on things that are happening. We're fortunate on this morning that we have Karen Slatery. Mm-hmm. We have our brother Mark from Neighborhood News. Yeah. And Mr. Harry Odom.
Okay.
Okay, who is a celebrity.
He is.
Well, I don't know about the celebrity part of it.
I feel like I'm sitting next to $1 million right now. Good morning, people.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Mm-hmm. Now, we're here to talk about the history of Bronzeville.
Yes.
Now, they're going to help both us out and our audience out. Because a lot of people always say, oh, it's just the ghetto.
Yeah, well, I mean.
Is that true?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
But to like myself and other black people who come from the South, the houses and things we lived in, that was like, I mean, luxury to us.
Yes.
Because, you know, being from the South and the segregation and so and seeing like the old shotgun houses, no running water, outdoor toilets and all of that. And when you come to Milwaukee, you had the old window toilet. We call it a commode that you flood.
You had
running water and stuff like that, and a bathtub. So it's kind of like, but then if you look at it, really was a ghetto.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say ghetto, but they weren't the best housing. It was the oldest part of the city, those houses.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, again, I think, you know, when you talk to, you know, and that's why it's so important that we keep the bridges strong and you know, between our elders and those of us who are younger, so that we can know our history,
you know,
and a lot of times we're disconnected from the information because we are not having these types of conversations. And, you know, one of the things that my mom and my dad always talked about is that when they first came to Milwaukee, how beautiful this city was, you know, and when you was down on Third Street, all the businesses and, you know, on Walnut, all the different businesses and how you could be out all night. And, you know, if you lost a job today, you can go and get another one tomorrow, you know. So, you know, when we look at where we have, I don't want to say evolved, but I guess where we're at today, you know, where we're at today in our communities, a lot of people don't know those good times, and that, you know, when our people were migrating from the South to the North, that there was so much opportunity here. And I think having you here helps us to talk, you know, helps us to understand that as well. So let's talk more about Bronzeville when you got here.
When I come to Bronzeville, actually the youngest girl, my sister Rose and I, my mom and dad sent us to live with her oldest sister and my uncle in Milwaukee. And I was like about 3 or 4, and Rose was like about 5 or 6, and so on. Because my aunt and uncle, they was up, they come as part of that migration in, I think, the late 1920s and so on. But when I was a kid growing up, when they said Bronzeville, a little Harlem, a little Africa, I didn't know or understand what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, you didn't understand. You was interested in playing and things like that. Mm-hmm. But some things that I did notice, living in Bronzeville, was that I noticed, like, across the street from us, there was a Greek Orthodox church. I saw white people in the neighborhood. When we finally started the school at 4th Street School, we had white teachers, didn't see black. There was some white kids going there and so on. Mm-hmm. And across the street from school, there was the brewery. The brewery was there, Slits, and so we saw white people walk. You didn't have to get on the back of the bus and so forth and things like that. That's but I mean, see, when I sit and talk to young people about this, it's hard for them to believe. Mm-hmm. When I tell them things about my growing up, that horses pull the beer keg wagons, that horses pull the garbage wagons.
You're going way back.
Well, you go back, it's been a minute. Then I can remember I was a kid, we used to go around this area that we call Chinatown, because there were like 2 or 3 blocks that a lot of
in
Chinese
Milwaukee?
People. Yes, in Milwaukee.
It was a Chinatown in Milwaukee?
Yeah, we call it, we refer to it as Chinatown.
Where was that at?
That was about, like, I think, State Street from like about, by 6th, 7th Street, right too close, not too far from St. Benedict School, in the area there.
It was a real Chinatown.
Yeah, that's what we would call it. Mm. And we walked everywhere. We walked everywhere too, and asked where the Pfizer Forum is, and where the old auditorium is, and the arena, and so on. That was all a part of Bronzeville.
Yeah.
And where we lived, we were about 3, 4, 5 blocks from the museum and Wisconsin Avenue, but we didn't venture down there too much because, you know, we black kids, and so we stayed in our neighborhood. But see, another thing that I tell them too is that people, like the businesses, a lot of black people own businesses, but did they really own the homes? Yeah. Were they leasing and so on? So I can remember Eli's Grocery, Sonny's Grocery. These are white people that own those. I remember Harry's Groceries. I remember Tompkins Ice Cream. I can remember a lot of that. They were owned by white people. There was a lot of people. Did they live there? Not some of them, of course, they didn't. Okay. But there were some black white people who lived in the neighborhood.
Yeah, well one of the things that I was always told is that in Bronzeville, people from all over the world came to Milwaukee to visit Bronzeville. Whether it was your Al Capones or Duke Ellingtons and, you know, just a lot of performers.
Oh, yeah.
And different people would come, and Bronzeville was that place where they would gather.
But they would, simply because the one thing I guess I could say now, and I don't know if I mentioned it at all before, how nice it was in Bronzeville, but I don't think a lot of people realize the segregation and the meanness was there, because this thing was good, but like, well, when you talk about the Duke Ellingtons and so-and-so, the entertainers that's coming, I don't know if Milwaukee would consider a part of the Chitlin circuit, but they couldn't stay in the hotels downtown. Mm. So you found that a lot of people who, like black people, would open up their home, that they would come and they would stay there. They would eat like on Wall Street. Even when Willie Mays and the other black ball players was playing in the AAA ball league, they could not stay downtown. They would come, and even when the Braves come, when the Braves come, you know, the Billy Bruins and the Henry Aaron and so, they didn't live in the white neighborhoods, and they lived in the area that Bronzeville, where black folks lived.
That's interesting. Brother Harry, I mean, you are definitely
a historian.
You are a wealth of information,
which helps me to understand why you are featured, you know, in this documentary. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, if we can bring you guys in, Ms. Karen and Mark, about the documentary. You know, how did you guys come together to decide that you were going to do this project? And, you know, how do we get to this place where you're with Harry today?
Okay. Mark works for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and I've worked there in the past and am retiring soon and will be there in the future. We were kind of attuned to stories about the neighborhoods. And Mark had met Sherry Williams Pinnell, who was doing a play she was writing and directing a play for First Stage Theater called Welcome to Bronzeville. And we were watching as she was interviewing Harry, Fred Reed, and others, and we started to hear their stories and thought, oh, wouldn't this be an interesting documentary, a backstory about what was going on in the 40s and 50s.
Right.
And so that's how we got involved.
Okay. And when you talk and as you started to do that research on what was happening in the 40s and 50s, what are some of the things that were most significant that stood out to you?
I think that the vibrancy of the community that was created despite the segregation and the things Harry was talking about.
Right.
I think that was so compelling, and it was eventually lost.
So in what way? Like when you say vibrancy, what?
Oh, the music, the social clubs, the talking about how neighbors cared for one another. What was interesting is I grew up in Menominee, Michigan, which is a small town in the Upper Peninsula, and there were no African Americans there.
Really?
But while I was listening to Harry and others talk, they were talking about the same values that I experienced growing up, with neighbors that cared about each other. So we didn't lock doors.
How long have you been in Milwaukee?
Gosh, about 30 years.
About 30 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, so coming from, let me ask you this question. Coming from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and never seeing being exposed to African American people, what was your perception of African American people before you interacted with them?
I think like an awful lot of white people, we hear narratives, the dominant narratives and themes that have been in the media.
Yes.
And it really, in the end, we're all people and care about the same things. So that's what, I mean, this just reinforced that.
Yeah, so having that lack of knowledge and then, or a perception, once you started to interact with African American people, what was the contrast between what you had been conditioned to think or what you had assumed as far as narratives, opposed to your actual interaction with black people?
They were beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, Dennis, I just want to add real quick. I grew up in a similar situation, but when Karen talks about Menominee and how it was a small town and people took care of each other and there was a watchful adult on every street corner area, as you said, you know, you better not misbehave because the word would get home before you did. Mm-hmm. Right? All of those stories in Menominee, which are the same as many of the stories we heard from folks who grew up in Bronzeville, Menominee was a much easier place to make all that happen.
Michigan.
So
you're from Menominee as well?
No, but I heard Karen's stories, okay. And I grew up in a similar situation.
Okay, and you're from where?
I'm from California originally,
okay.
L.A.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So the thing that struck me was in Menominee, Karen and her family and the people in their neighborhood didn't have the same challenges, right? They didn't have segregation. They didn't have economic and social discrimination. And the folks who built Bronzeville and made Bronzeville happen were able to do the same kinds of things under much more difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what struck me.
And when we talk about the people who built Bronzeville, who were the people who built Bronzeville?
Harry, why don't you take that one? Well, there's so many.
Well, there was a lot of it. But actually, you know, in the early years, the black population in Milwaukee was so small.
Mm-hmm.
It was real small. It was real small in numbers. But as the years went on, it started increasing. You know, you had that big, after the Civil War in the South, you had probably one of the biggest migrations in this country's history.
The Civil War was when?
1861 to 1865. Mm-hmm. And after the war and during Reconstruction, and after that, then the Black Codes coming, you had this big migration.
Mm-hmm.
And that migration took for years, because that was like about 4 million blacks who would move from the South to cities like Milwaukee, mm-hmm. Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and so on. And basically, they kind of followed the railroads. Where the railroads went, you know, that's where they kind of followed, and they would settle. And so, and then later on, you know, that was the job opportunities were better. People saw it better, and so on. So basically, a lot of people built it. That was a lot of things that happened. That people that in Milwaukee, for instance, like the gentleman who recruited blacks to work over with Jones Island, so they had barracks and so on, the black would recruit blacks and so on. They would recruit blacks from the South for strike breakers and things like that. But there was so many people who built Bronzeville. You can go back to Columbia Savings and Loans, and Mr. Johnson, and people from the Beloit area and so on. So there's so many people who contributed to the building of Bronzeville. And the role that females played in it, the role that the church played, and the role that the social clubs played. And like I think I told Karen and Mark, when I was a kid, growing, my father would take me to the barbershop on Saturday. And that was kind of a social gathering for us little kids up there, and our little heads be going back and forth. Because we saw, and I'm going to say this, we saw the preachers there. We saw the pimps there and the players there and so on. But they taught us things. They taught us lessons like how to treat women, how to dress, staying close to the church, staying close to God, that you are somebody. And things like, so there were so many people that contributed to Bron from the social, political, economic standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how involved blacks at that time was in the political system. Because when I got old and grew, I can't remember people coming, like campaigning for mayor or campaigning for the city council. I think that was a no-no the people come in black in the black neighborhood and saw it, because I can't remember seeing that. Cause what you see today, they on TV, got the signs in your yard, so and so for mayor, so and so for representative, and so forth. I don't remember seeing that, and I can't remember. I'm not saying that they didn't, but I can't remember my mom or dad, my aunts and uncles, and the older one even said they're going to vote. I can't remember that. If it happened, I don't remember it happened.
Right.
And I think that was something that if it happened, I would remember. But that.
Well, you brought up something. You mentioned Columbia Savings and Loans. And I think a lot, it's interesting because I was just there yesterday looking to meet with the president to talk about how, you know, the history of Columbia. Mm-hmm. You know, can you talk a little bit about that as how it was a contributor to Bronzeville?
Well, see, at the time that I guess from the standpoint and doing my research and reading and asking people and so forth, at the time, it was difficult when blacks come to get loans for homes and so on, because there's always been discrimination from that standpoint and so on. So Mr. and Mrs. Halyard established savings and loans, and I don't know what their assets was or when they started, but they were the one who started giving loans to black people that they could afford to buy homes or start businesses and things like that.
Really?
And Ashley, one of the Halyards, his sister, she was a member of our church.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she passed away. I guess she was in her 90s, about, I would say, probably 2 or 3 years ago. And I should sit and talk with her quite a bit about what she remembered, et cetera. And matter of fact, I was fortunate enough to have a grandson. I was his administrator when I was at Prince Edward Junior High School.
Wow, and we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that in a minute as well, because you have a very rich history here in the city of Milwaukee as an educator and a lot of other things as well, which I think, again, helps me understand why you are the superstar in this
film. I'm just a regular guy.
We could have brought you a dozen people.
Yeah.
I can imagine. But again, just the fact that you guys were able to do this research, let's talk about some of the other people that you were able to to feature in this documentary.
And then I also want to know, how long was the developmental process in building this film as well, and making this film as well?
Long. Harry used to call and say, "Are you done yet?"
Yeah, I can. Well, we did the 53206 documentary, and that was, people don't know, it took us about 2 years to get that thing done. You know, and then when it came out, it just went where it went. So I understand the process can be. It's very intimate, let's just put it like that, and personal.
A lot of research.
Yeah.
A lot of trying to find people and getting permission to do this and do that and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It took us actually about 4 years to do it.
4 years,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So you guys have been working on this that long?
Yeah.
Yes, wow.
So before we go into that, many people may not know where Bronzeville is right now today. I mean, it's just sad to say. Mm-hmm. A lot of people may not know what Bronzeville is. If you can just briefly explain where it is and where does it run from.
Well, Harry, I think traditionally it was 3rd Street, now King Drive, to 12th and maybe State up to Keefe.
I don't think it went to Keefe. I would probably say when I was a kid, probably to North Avenue. If I can kind of describe it, I think it going west, it was probably the east side of 12th Street. And going east, it was probably like 3rd Street, which is King Drive, and south, it went south like Winnebago, Juneau, and down in that area. And north, I would probably say, it went up probably to Garfield, or North Avenue, or Monarchy. Of course, I ended up going to North Division, but at that time, I'm going to North Division. There wasn't a lot of people that live in the neighborhood that looked like me, so things like that. So,
okay. Yeah.
But now it's changed.
Yeah, it's changed a whole lot.
I kind of saw after my dad was killed, I kind of saw the breaking, a little cracks, because after my dad killed, we moved us on 17th and Cherry, and that was a few blocks northwards, 12th Street and so forth. And of course, I was gone those 6 or 7 years. When I come back, it really had changed and so forth.
So let me ask this to you, Brother Harry. You know, today we have a lot of challenges that are in our communities today we've gotten to this place. Do you see any similarities in the things that we're dealing with today that are the same as when you were growing up in Bronzeville?
Some.
Such as?
Some, like the one thing that I like people that maybe my age that we consider elders and so forth, I know we have a responsibility not to tell young people you can't do this, you can't do that, but we have a responsibility as an elder. You come to us and we try to give you the best advice possible. We're not going to say you can't do this and that and so on. So we don't want you to make the mistakes that we made, and we want you to appreciate those things that people's shoulders that we stood on, that you can stand on and contribute. And so there's still I think a lot of similarity. There are still people who care. The church still care. All those things have expanded a lot of because of technology and so forth. But I'm a firm believer. The media doesn't do us justice a lot. Because I believe this, and when I'm around the country speaking and so forth, whether it's in Indianapolis, whether it's in Birmingham and so forth, 10%. That 10% is, I call it the negative 10%. 90 to 95% of the kids and people are trying to do the right thing. They're still concerned about education. They're still concerned about this and that and so on. But it's that 10 to 15% that get all of the attention in the news. See, and I always say bad news sells itself. But good news, you have to tell somebody and hope that the right person is listening.
No, definitely, definitely. Let's go back over here real quick when we talk about others that were in the documentary.
And let me just say this, Milwaukee, if you're just now tuning in, we're talking to, I'm just so excited, the cast. Can we say the cast? The cast, the producers, the historian over here talking about the history of Bronzeville. All right, let's go.
Well, real quick, we interviewed about 16 people who, in depth, who were children during the period. And some of the folks we interviewed are names that obviously people will recognize, like Reuben Harpole, Fred Reed, Le Havre Buck, who's a preacher on 7th Street. And then some of the people we interviewed, I think, are names that you wouldn't have heard before. And we made an effort to include both kinds of folks, you know, in the film. We wanted to hear from people who everybody recognizes, and also from people who haven't been heard before.
What's some of the names of those people who haven't been
I don't know, Irene Goggins. Now, I guess she's on the prominent side, right? She's somebody everybody knew before she passed away. I don't think Bob Mays, who was in the real estate business, has a lot of prominence as somebody who's recognized as a historical figure. Norma Jean and Granville Sims, wonderful people. And, of course, Sally Jackson, who I think is somebody who hasn't been heard from a lot.
Gotcha.
And Martha Freeman. Do you know Martha Freeman? She's on 27th and Atkinson.
Okay.
Right. And she has a
Mother Freeman.
A storefront church, right? And she's kind of the grandma on the block.
Yes, she is.
And she told us that, you know, the things I do now to keep an eye on the neighborhood are the things I learned when I was growing up in Bronzeville.
So let me ask you guys this, right? Coming into this experience with doing the research and learning about the history of African Americans in Bronzeville and being white people, how was that experience for you in learning about the African American community and the history of it? What type of experience was that for you?
It's a tremendously enriching experience, and one I hope more people can experience, and that's, you know, in part the reason for the film.
Yeah.
I think if we're going to talk about issues related to race in the city, we have to know how did it get this way? What happened? And this is a way of getting that story out there.
Yeah. So are some of those narratives, are the things that are being hit on in this documentary when we talk about race and race relations, things of that nature?
The story is really about the community and the people who live there and what they did to create the community.
Okay.
And then how it was destroyed. So it's really kind of a straightforward story.
Okay. So I'm sorry, you want to say something, Harry?
I think the party did a tremendous part. And then when they talked about, like, when you saw urban renewal.
Okay.
We talked about how to destroy and how it was intentionally done, where the expressway went. A lot of people didn't realize that Ashley was originally supposed to go up 16th Street. but deciding because they would have to destroy so much on the south side of those homes, so they kind of shifted to 6th Street and so. But I thought that brought up, and I think people, if you could understand that, and this was something that was not just done in Milwaukee, in Indianapolis, a lot of what they consider the inner city. So it was politically involved, political, I think, driven.
So when you said talk about the urban renewal, that was the plan that they implemented. That in your opinion is what contributed to the destruction of Bronzeville. Right.
I think there were basically three things that did. And the first was public housing, which sounds on its face like a good thing. Mm-hmm. But the problem was that it worked well for some, the people who got to move into the houses. But they tore down more houses than right. they rebuilt. Mm-hmm. And when you've got a confined neighborhood, where do people go?
Right.
And so that was an issue. Then,
so the houses that were torn down were houses that were occupied by Black people.
Oh, sure, that was some of those were like middle class.
So it was eminent domain, I'm assuming.
Well, yeah, a lot of was through eminent domain.
Okay,
yeah.
And they bought them, but they often bought the houses at a lower price than they were worth.
Right,
and so that created problems for people who couldn't get loans to buy new ones elsewhere.
Yeah, which we're going
prices.
Through that today in our community.
Sure,
yeah.
sure.
And see, one thing, when they did that, you found like Blacks, they couldn't go outside of that circle. Basically, they couldn't go to the Wauwatosa so you was kind of locked in.
Well, again, that's why I asked what were the similarities between then and now, and you still have a lot of those same, barriers that are up today. Black people being confined to specific areas and not really going outside of their boundaries.
Well, see, one thing that I think that it helped, and one thing I think that helped, and people, and I say this, and when we was kids growing up, when you would take the county transit or the bus, it did not travel like it go outside of the county now. Like it started, went with 60th Street on Valley Street, then it would turn around and so forth. And now you can take the bus to the airport and come back and stuff like that. But so that gave an opportunity that people could get on the bus and see more and move around, et cetera, and so on. But still, there are certain places in Milwaukee that people may say, well, what you doing off the plantation?
Yeah, definitely. Now, you were saying, we said urban renewal, but you said there were three things that were contributors.
Right.
What were the other two things that you discovered?
Well, the first was the public housing, then urban renewal, and that's when Walnut Street was decimated. Mm-hmm. And then the third was the freeway that went through Bronzeville.
Right.
And that displaced a lot of people as well.
Through research, and again, we've heard these stories a lot, just in bits and pieces. Now, were those three steps specifically a strategic plan to dismantle or divide the Black community at that time?
I think it divided the community, but I think it was intentionally done, because when you see something in Indianapolis and you see something in Cleveland and other black neighborhoods, the same thing happened.
Mm-hmm. Same
so it's not all by accident. Mm-hmm. So it's a strategic plan. In the documentary that I wasn't in it, but I did some contributing, it was called about Christmas Addicts High School in Indianapolis, where Oscar Robinson and my wife and I went to school. Mm-hmm. It was called A School That Opened Up a City. Mm-hmm. And basically they showed that part of urban renewal coming there, and what area that they live in, Lockville and so and so, the same thing. Didn't replace those homes and so forth. Mm-hmm. So where you was gonna go?
Right.
So it to me, it was intentionally done because it's all the similarities in the different cities.
Man, I think this is a lot of great information.
So I guess what we all want to know is, when would this film be aired?
Yeah.
The film is showing on Thursday night, October 31st, on public television.
So it hasn't started yet.
No. Then it will be aired 6 more times on public channel 1036 over in November.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds great.
And we're going to put all of these on our Facebook page, the times and the dates as well, okay?
Was this film in the film festival?
No.
It wasn't?
It should have been.
Okay.
But I do need to say one thing.
Go right ahead.
Marquette University gave us a lot of the money. They underwrote a lot of this film
really?
As part of a creative research project.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And Dennis, guess who happens to be the script consultant?
Who?
Mr. Claiborne Benson.
Oh, wow. It makes perfect sense.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up Claiborne, because Claiborne was one of my first students when I started an Afro-American history class in the Milwaukee Public Schools. He was one of my students.
Really?
And you know, you never know the effects that you have on a person, maybe that day or years later. And we was at something that we were doing in an auditorium in MPS, and Claiborne said that Mr. Oden is the reason that I decided to go into Black history. That's what he told that class.
Really?
And I was just shocked. So you never know how many people you influence. And a lot of times it's not about money.
Yeah.
It's about the lives that you touch.
Yes, sir.
And those people who become contributing citizens to society.
That's
is what Claiborne has done. He become a tremendous contributor to the society, the community of Milwaukee. He goes nationwide, internationally, and so on. So I'm really proud of Claiborne, the gentleman's son who founded Black Holocaust Museum. I was his administrator.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about that.
That's in closing, you know, because we can have you here all day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're gonna make sure people don't get all the information here. We're gonna steer them to the documentary so they can actually watch it. But let's talk a little bit more about your history in Milwaukee, and you know, where you started and where you are right now.
Well, actually, I mentioned earlier that the youngest girl and I, Rose, come to live with my aunt and uncle, and then, of course, my dad got a job and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I did all of my schooling in Milwaukee from elementary school. I went to 4th Street School,
mm-hmm.
and then I went to Roosevelt and then ventured to North Division, which I graduated.
So you are an MPS kid.
Yeah, basically, I'm an MPS kid. But I would always go back during the summer in schools. I would visit my grandparents in the South and things, and I saw a lot.
What part of the South?
I'm originally from Alabama. I'm from a little town called Talladega. And matter of fact, I was born 2 blocks in a log cabin from historical Talladega College,
Ooh.
which is the oldest HBCU in the state of Alabama,
okay.
right, and so on. But and still got a lot of relatives there and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But at the North Division, I went to the University of Minnesota in Duluth. And that is another story in itself.
Yeah.
I was Gene Hamilton and I, who we were high school basketball players, and we were supposed to go back to the Big Ten school. But the coach that we ended up playing for, he didn't take the Big Ten job, so he told us to stay up there. I didn't know nothing about Duluth and so on and so. Because the farther north I had been when I was a kid was to Madison playing in the state tournament.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really quite an experience. That was the years that I went there playing basketball and so forth. I asked Coach Olson, he was getting interviewed for the Laker job.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Mr. Olson, why didn't you take the job at the Minneapolis Twin City campus ago? He said, because of the gentleman's agreement. I didn't know what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So as I got, I did some research. The University of Minnesota did not recruit Black basketball players. I ended up being up the first 2 Black basketball players that the U of M system recruited.
Yeah.
I ended up being the first Black one to ever start to be all conference, being in. That's another story.
Yeah, yeah, we had to bring you back. But that's a whole other documentary
right there. But, and at the time.
Let me ask you this. Now, your parents. Okay, growing up, what did your parents do? What were their backgrounds?
Well, my father worked Ware Steel when he come was a foundry.
In the South?
No, in Milwaukee when he got that job. When I remember my mom telling me when living in the South, he worked in a cotton mill
mm-hmm.
where he worked there. And my mom would say that they did work like for white people, like domestics and things like
mm-hmm.
that. And then when it come to work, my father got the job at Ware Steel with my uncles, aunts, and my uncles all worked there. And then my mother worked for the city for years and so on, like McKinley Beach and other parts of the city, the hospitals.
Okay,
and so on.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I came to, and then as you went through the school system, went through college. So you had scholarships to play basketball as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
And speaking of basketball, is there any relation to Lamar Odom? Are you in relation to Lamar
Odom?
No, I'm
Greg O's cousin. Greg was the first draft choice in
that game.
Okay.
Yeah.
And my name is O-D-E-N.
O-D-E-N. Okay.
Greg Oden. Gotcha. So, okay, post-basketball, post your basketball career in college, you moved on into what?
Actually, I went and had – I really kind of took a dab into pro baseball and then pro basketball, but I always wanted to teach. I love teaching. Mm-hmm. Even today, I love teaching, mm-hmm. even being an administrator and so mm-hmm. on. But I taught for like 5 years in the MPS, and then I went into administration. I was in administration for 31 years. Mm-hmm. When I spoke for administration, did things like the an assistant principal. I was a principal. The administrative specialist was in charge of all of the high schools in the MPS. I did special assignments for the superintendent. I was assistant director of school safety and security and so on. I did a lot of mentoring and training for individuals to go into teaching and so on. And I still kind of work and teach at the University of Minnesota. Mostly I do my work at the Duluth campus, but I advise the chancellor and vice and president of the entire campus. And I manage my scholarship at the university that has a scholarship named after me. Mm-hmm. And I set some of those aside for kids from MPS. Mm-hmm. Who've gone? Some of those are principals in Minneapolis. Some matter of fact, one works in the county department for Miller Course. His wife is a doctor. Some is Wells Fargo and so on. And I have some all over the country. I have some kids who played pro basketball and pro football and such.
So you were one of the first blacks to be to attend and play basketball at in Duluth in Minneapolis. And now you're still there to this day?
Well, I still work. Yeah, man, I just come from there last week.
I just came from there last week, too, actually.
Matter of fact, when they started with Charlotte, my scholar, Tony Dungy, and a lot of them gave a lot of money to the scholarship.
Yeah.
And I can give as many as, in style, we gave out 7. Mm-hmm. And we can give as many as 50 a year for $3,000. And they can get it a sophomore, juniors, and senior year. Mm-hmm. It's not a scholarship that you need a 3.5. We make sure 2.5 you sure need. Mm-hmm. 60% of it goes to Afro-Americans. The other 40% is divided among Native Americans who do not qualify for tribal fund, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, the physically handicapped, cap and so on. So that's probably maybe 600, 700 Harry Owen scholars. And I'd be remiss if I wouldn't say how that scholarship was established. Mm-hmm. A gentleman by the name of Ken Foxworth. Ken is from St. Louis. He was a football player. Now, Ken was way behind me. Now, I've been out of school for years because Ken ended up playing football at the Minneapolis campus with Tony Dungy and some of the others. And so Ken, I would say, probably had a special need. And they said Ken would never graduate from high school, would never graduate from college. So what Ken did, he graduated from high school. He ended up going to the University of Minnesota because he was recruited. And he played in the general college. He got that 2-year degree with it there. Then he ended up getting his 4-year degree. And then Ken went out somewhere, and I'm quite sure it might be Dr. Ken Foxworth right now. Mm-hmm. But what Ken, when he became the head of the minority coordinator at the Minneapolis, the Duluth campus, Ken saw that there was a need for kids of color that wasn't good. So he decided to run. He's going to run from the capital of Minneapolis, in Minneapolis, up to City Hall steps in Duluth, which is about like 180 miles or something like that. And Ken had to lose about 70 pounds or something mm-hmm. like that, I mean, because it blew up. And he called me. He ran like a marathon. He did it in 6 days. He didn't run on Sunday, like 26 miles. He'd run 13 miles, then go do a radio show. And so Ken called me and said that, and at that time, Dr. Ianni was the chancellor, and the chancellor, like the president of that campus. They called me and said, I want you at City Hall on so-and-so. So I said, okay, I'll be up there. Got up there, and when he entered there on City Hall, he named the scholarship the Harry Owen Minority Disability Scholarship.
Oh, wow.
And then he didn't get enough money. Now, the two guys that I played basketball with at the university, Dave Baker and Tom Stone, they gave $30,000. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't enough. So, Ken said, I'm going to do it again next year.
God. Oh, wow. That's
and I said, wait a minute, Ken. I said, you don't have to do that. I said, I'm going to do it again next year. I said, okay, if you do it, I will run the last 2 days with you.
Yeah.
I only ran 52 miles, but Ken, they extended it from Two Harbors, Minnesota to Minneapolis campus. He ran over 200 miles.
That's
man, Mr. Odin, we can have you here all day long. Because, again, you are definitely a wealth of information mm-hmm. and knowledge. I just want to thank you guys. In closing, is there anything that you would like to say? Again, the film will be airing when?
On October 31st mm-hmm. at 7:30.
Can you say it just a little bit louder?
Sure. On October 31st mm-hmm. at 7:30 on public television here in Milwaukee.
That's Halloween.
I know.
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So get out the trick-or-treat candy and turn on the TV. Right?
There you go.
And, of course, Neighborhood News Service, mm-hmm. Which is really our home and the reason we were able to connect with you folks. And
yeah.
Don't forget to check it out.
Yes.
Definitely.
It was an honor.
MilwaukeeNS.org.
It's an honor. Definitely.
I would be very remiss if I didn't say this. But all of the people that contributed to this documentary, what Karen and Mark have done, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The time and the patience, all the other people like the Ruben Harper, and I know I'm going to miss someone. They were simply fantastic. And everyone that contributed to Granville and so on, they saw it from a different, and they got all perspectives
mm-hmm.
at different ages. Some of them older than I and so on, but they got it all for them. But the thing, we all had the same thing in common.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up in Granville, an area that we love. And it made us become contributing outstanding citizens. I want to appreciate what Mark, mm-hmm. what Mark and Karen, they did a fantastic job.
No, I want to thank you. I want to thank you guys for coming in.
Yes.
Again, these are the stories that we need to shine more of a light on. I think you have everybody in our listener audience ready for October 31st mm-hmm. to watch this Bronzeville documentary.
It's actually coming on October 31st, November the 1st, November the 3rd, November the 5th. On Channel 10, and then on Channel 36, mm-hmm. November 3rd, November 5th, and November the 10th. All of these dates and times are going to be on our Facebook page, okay? You got to check them out. I can't wait to check it out.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward
okay.
to it. But thank you
yes.
so much for
thank
coming.
You so
and
much.
Thank you for
thank
the work
you.
That you've done. Four
mm-hmm.
years is not an easy task to pull something like this together.
Mm-hmm.
So we appreciate all that you're doing.
But I think
thank
it's well worth Harry. The wait, Dennis.
Oh, wow. I mean, and again, just
well
to have people like Harry
yes.
here. And if Harry's just who you got here,
mm-hmm.
we can't even imagine how many others that we would love to do an interview with as
for
well.
Sure.
Because, I mean, you know, you just put the mic in front of Harry, you're going to learn everything.
You got it. Thank you all so much
thank
again.
You,
okay?
Thank you so much.
All right, y'all. Keep it locked to AM 1560, WGOB, 96.1 FM. Keep it here.
You're listening to the WGLB Morning Mix with Sister Soraya and Brother.